This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin völlig blind. Manchmal habe ich das Gefühl, meine Tage und Nächte sind auf den Kopf gestellt, weil ich Schwierigkeiten habe, nachts zu schlafen und tagsüber wach zu bleiben. Ich leide unter NON24, einer seltenen Schlaf-Wach-Rhythmusstörung, die viele völlig blinde Menschen betrifft. Möchtest du mehr über diese Erkrankung in Verbindung mit völliger Erblindung erfahren? Rufe kostenfrei an unter 0800 24 24 008.
Hey Leute, ich bin Pinocchio und ihr hört Holz arbeitet, der Gen Z Finance Career Promi Podcast. Zu Beginn ein Dank an unseren Sponsor, Firefox, der Browser, der für dich gemacht ist. Das sind doch alle Browser. Also ich meine, Firefox ist ja jetzt nicht privater als andere Browser.
Pinocchio? Flunkerst du schon wieder?
Nee, alles in Ordnung. Ach Menno, da will man einmal edgy sein.
Wähl einen Browser, der für dich gemacht ist. Wähl Firefox.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Thursday, the 14th of November. Brexit is back in the news. The Governor of the Bank of England urges the city to welcome any chance to improve ties with the EU. We'll be asking whether the UK is at a trading crossroads between a United States threatening tariffs and Europe offering access, but at a price. We've live and lively discussion. Donald Trump's son confirms that the scion of another famous political family, Robert Kennedy, a vaccine skeptic, is to be nominated by the president-elect to run US health policy. The plight of those who live the lives of troglodytes as they struggle for gold in South Africa's abandoned mines, and hear how to make a high-rise housing estate livable. You're listening to The World Tonight with Sean Lay. He's just pointing out the consequences of Brexit, the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey said tonight, as he urged his city audience to welcome opportunities to rebuild relations with the European Union.
I've said many times as a public official, I take no position on Brexit per se, and that's very important. But I do have to point out consequences. The changing trading relationship with the EU has weighed on the level of potential supply. The impact on trade seems to be more in goods than services, which I don't think is particularly surprising. But it underlines why we must be alert to and welcome opportunities to rebuild relations while respecting that very important decision of the British people.
It's unlikely, though, that his intervention will be viewed charitably by those who believe that Brexit unshackled the British economy from EU regulations. Many of them look hopefully to the imminent return of Donald Trump to the White House, believing this time a UK-US free trade deal could be possible. Mr. Trump, though, says tariff is his favourite word and is prepared to impose them on imports at potentially eye-watering levels in order to protect the US economy from what he regards as unfair competition. Which raises the question of whether the UK may have to choose trade across the Channel or trade across the Atlantic. In her speech at the Mansion House prior to the Governor's, Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, said the government would act in the national interest as it navigates what she called geopolitical uncertainty in the years ahead.
That means free and open trade, especially with our most economically important partners. That includes the United States, our single most important destination for financial services trade. And there is so much potential for us to deepen our economic relationship on areas such as emerging technologies. I look forward to working closely with President-elect Trump and his team to strengthen our relationship in the years ahead. And of course, our biggest trading partner is the European Union. We will not be reversing Brexit or re-entering the single market or customs union, but we must reset our relationship.
Well, I asked the BBC's economics editor, Faisal Islam, standing on a noisy road junction outside Mansion House, why the governor had chosen to make his intervention now.
He is very diplomatic, shy, if you like, to talk about the issue of Brexit. So this intervention at a speech in front of bankers, in front of the Chancellor herself, is pretty significant, I think, to sort of lean in to that concern that the Brexit deal, the sort of rather distant hard Brexit, as it was called, that didn't prioritise existing trade relations, that that has had an impact on the economy. Consequences, as he said it. His quote is that he doesn't take a public position on Brexit, but he has to point out its consequences. And the context here in his speech is about why the British economy has performed relatively poorly in historical terms over the past few years. So this is one of three or four key factors. But then he goes on to say this, which, although it's not a political intervention and it may be described as a statement of current government policy, I think is quite significant. He says that Britain must be alert to and welcome opportunities to rebuild relations with the European Union. The context being, this is to bankers in front of the Chancellor at the key strategic speech that a Chancellor and a Bank of England governor makes every year.
How much is Donald Trump on the governor's mind, do you think, when he makes remarks of this kind, and the emphasis the president-elect has made on using tariffs as a tool to achieve both his economic interests and his foreign policy objectives?
I think when we get the chance to ask him, he'll say, oh no, I'd have said this anyway. This is just a statement of reality. But everybody knows the content. Everybody knows that if you believe what he promised on the campaign trail, there's a viable path to a significant trade war between Western allies if the Trump administration were to levy 10 to 20% tariffs on every single import going into the US. Now, I have spoken to Trump's trade advisors, the chief trade advisor, over the past few years. His view was very clearly that the United Kingdom faces a choice between getting closer to the US or remaining in the orbit of the EU. The stated policy of this government is to get a bit closer to the EU. What does it do now? There is something of a Y junction right now. What you will hear from cabinet ministers is, oh, we can do both. I don't know if they all really believe that, but against that context, you're absolutely right, for the governor to make this interjection, I think shows there are choices to be made on massive issues of geo-economic strategy that they can't have expected even a few weeks or a few months ago. And at this moment, I know, for example, I spoke today to the Spanish finance minister, plenty of European officials offering a strengthened, more cooperative post-Brexit deal with the current government. All of that stuff is on the table. The British government has not yet returned serve on that. These decisions will have to be made very quickly in the next few weeks. And it's interesting, when I put this to the Treasury, they've just replied to me. They have said, well, you know, we want a closer relationship with the European Union, and that the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will become the first finance minister since the referendum to go to the meeting of Eurozone European finance ministers next month. So they're trying to communicate closeness. I think the other backdrop to this is the search for growth. That's one of the themes here for the Chancellor. It's been tough. It's been tricky. We didn't have it in the budget. It must be tempting to press a button that offers a set of policies that would ostensibly grow the economy. It might satisfy some of the markets too, but would not cost you anything in terms of tax and spend.
Faisal Islam, BBC's economics editor outside Mansion House. Let's hear now from the Labour MP Stella Creasy, who chairs the Labour Movement for Europe, and Sir John Redwood, former Conservative Cabinet Minister who championed Brexit. Welcome to you both. Thank you for being with us. Sir John, the Governor says he's pointing out the consequences of Brexit, not expressing a pro or anti opinion. Are you willing to listen to him?
Well, of course you listen to the Governor, but I think you should check the data. If you take our trading arrangement since the referendum in 2016, the good news is that our exports to the United States of America are up by 70% and to the EU are up by 44%, well ahead of inflation over that time period. And of course, he should recognise that this success is particularly concentrated in services, which is the dominant part of our exports now. More than 55% of our exports are services. I don't think anybody's talking about threatening services with tariffs. We have enormous further scope for growth. And since Brexit, we've managed to put more services provisions into agreements with the rest of the world. The rest of the world now, of course, is the dominant part of our trade. It's 59% of our trade compared with only 41% for the EU. And it's a much bigger opportunity for services because it's many more countries that are English language and English-based systems where we're easier to sell directly to them.
Stella Creasy, is he then, in a sense, rather overstating the impact of Brexit? I mean, there are other factors involved, aren't there? We've all seen the effect of inflation collectively in many countries. We've also seen the impact of COVID and, of course, the energy crisis caused by the war in Ukraine.
Yes, but I don't actually think I can let John get away with such a selective misreading of the figures. If we are honest, as the governor of the Bank of England is pointing out, our exports have been hit, particularly to Europe, where that is still the biggest market. Obviously, we do export to America, and John is right that exports have increased. But comparatively to the markets with our neighbours, it is a third of what we're talking about. John's recipe and focus on services misses the points for goods. Are we really saying, as a nation, we're going to forget our manufacturers and our small and medium enterprises who are crying out for a reduction in the paperwork that Brexit has created for them, in the hope that we can somehow manage that with our services industry?
Right.
Now, that's a debate we might want to have, but John needs to be honest. As the governor of the Bank of England has done today, we've taken a big hit because of Brexit, and we're continuing to take a big hit of Brexit, now the economic situations are changing.
You've both made your points on that. Let me try and move the discussion on, and this is the question of the election of Donald Trump. It sounded, listening to Rachel Reeves tonight, Stella Creasy, as if she saw an opportunity there. It's not about moving closer to the EU. It's actually about trying desperately, to work closely with Donald Trump's team so that presumably we don't get hit by tariffs.
Well, I think all of us are curious as to what President Trump will do when he gets into office in January, but also recognise you can fight many things in life. You can't fight geography. Our European counterparts are looking to us to say, OK, you want to reset the relationship. What might that look like? And they are offering to talk, and they're offering to talk about many things that respect the fact that Brexit has happened, but are going to help British businesses, British workers, with the paperwork, with the costs, with the friction that Brexit has created. That can only be a good thing. I do worry in some of the discussion, you know, President Trump is a smart man. The idea that somehow we can flatter him, that may well work on a television show, but the reality is he's a smart man who will look at the deal. We are stronger making deals when we're in good partnerships. And what I hear very strongly from our counterparts in Europe is that they are absolutely willing to talk, but we shouldn't try their patience. There's a real danger here that if we don't look at what we can do to improve conditions for British workers and British businesses, we may end up with nothing from either side.
Right. So, John, let me come back to you. As the head of Margaret Thatcher's policy unit in Number 10 before you became an MP, one might assume you are instinctively a free trader. Does the prospect of US tariffs alarm you?
Well, can I first of all just point out that Stella didn't give any numbers, and I was using official statistics to show that our trade has done extremely well.
Okay.
11% from the parliamentary
briefings. Our trade has done well since 2016.
Right. So, John, I'm sorry to cut you off. All I would say, given that we've got limited time, given that people can go and look this stuff up, and given you did give the figures, can I just ask you to address that tariff point? Thank you.
Yes, well, on tariffs, no, I don't want to see tariffs. I've been pointing out that the biggest part of our trade is services, which will be fortunately not facing tariffs. I'm a very strong promoter of British exports of goods. One of the reasons why our goods trade is not growing as quickly as our services trade is, of course, decisions of various governments. Two of our top six exports are still oil and oil products, but it is clearly government policy to run down our oil as quickly as possible. So when you've got that kind of overarching policy objective, it's telling against the idea of building our exports in one of the things that has been top export for the United Kingdom in goods. But what I think we can do, because we're not in the EU, is that we can avoid a knee-jerk, retaliatory, hostile tariff reaction if we do seem to be getting caught up in a general tariff on goods that Mr. Trump wishes to impose. And this is where we do want our government to live up to the fine words of Prime Minister and Chancellor, saying that they can get on with President Trump and that they're building a decent relationship with him. Because there's every reason to suppose that as President Trump is a lover of the United Kingdom and our royal family and many of the aspects of our lives, that we should be able to do a better deal with Mr. Trump. And everybody knows that Mr. Trump is all about doing deals.
Now, forgive me, I'm going to give you 15 seconds each. I apologise for this. You'll be conscious of time, as our listeners will be. Can we do both, or will we have to decide between the EU and the US? John Redwood.
No, of course you don't decide between them. You want to be friends with your allies and your neighbours, and you want the best deals with both.
But thank you.
We need concentration on the British national interest in both cases.
Stella Creasy.
the British national interest is to get on and do a good deal with Europe and then be partners in working out what President Trump is going to do from January onwards. Time is of the essence. I want us to get on with it.
Stella Creasy, Labour MP, Sir John Redwood, former Conservative MP. Thank you both very much for joining us. Coming up in the next 25 minutes, a new report suggests the built environment affects our mood. I've been to one post-war estate which isn't pretty, but which the residents seem to love.
I just love it to live here, you know. I like the community, I like the people. The only thing I will miss is probably more benches so we can like sit down and maybe even have a coffee, you know.
You are listening to The World Tonight at approaching 22 minutes past 10. Now, the US President-elect Donald Trump, yes, we're back on him again, has nominated Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health and Human Services. RFK, as he's commonly known, is an environmental lawyer and vaccine skeptic, as the son of the former US Attorney General, also called Robert Kennedy, and the nephew of President John F. Kennedy. He's a member of one of the Democrats' most storied families. This year, he ran for president as an independent, eventually dropping out and backing Donald Trump. This is Mr. Trump speaking about him in his victory speech in Florida last week, the day after the election.
These are fantastic people, and we can add a few names like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He came in, and he's going to help make America healthy again. And now he's a great guy, and he really means it. He wants to do some things, and we're going to let him go to it. I just said, but Bobby, leave the oil to me.
Well, the BBC's Jessica Parker is in Florida, where she's monitoring the transition operations at Mar-a-Lago. Jessica, thanks very much for coming on to talk about this. Let's talk, first of all, before we talk about whether he'll get through, because he has to be approved, as it were. He has to go through a process. What power would the head of the health department have? And has he given us any idea of how, if he is successful, he'd use it?
Yeah, I mean, this is a cabinet-level role, hence why it needs Senate approval. So it's a powerful position, and Donald Trump's made it pretty clear in the run-up to this announcement that he's willing to let RFK Jr. pretty much, I paraphrase, but do as he pleases, giving him a wide range of powers. It wasn't actually clear, it was very clear he was going to get a job, RFK Jr., though he had himself sort of more mooted this idea of being a health czar. But this is actually taking charge at a very senior level. I mean, look, in terms of what he might do, there are things he's talked about that are not so contentious. So he's raised concerns about processed foods, chemicals, obesity, the impact on the health of children in the United States. But he has also, as you said, been well known as a vaccine skeptic, one of the most prominent vaccine skeptics in the United States, and someone I think who gained a particularly new audience during the COVID pandemic. And he has promoted other debunked health claims as well. So I think the Senate confirmation process could be interesting, but let's face it, this isn't the only contentious appointment that Donald Trump is making to his top team.
Certainly not, but he doesn't have a health background as such, does he? He's as an environmental lawyer, and then in political terms, of course, as someone who went from being very prominent among Democrats to basically running first an independent and then endorsing Donald Trump, to the horror of many, of course, of his late father's allies.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. So his career was, as you say, he was an environmental lawyer. And he will be, again, among those people being picked by Donald Trump whose qualifications and experience are being very much questioned for the suitability of the role that they are being put in. It's interesting, though, because that may be the case, but he has managed to really get the ear of Donald Trump over the recent time, since dropping out, of course, as you say, of the presidential race and throwing his weight behind him. I've been in West Palm Beach all of this week. People have seen RFK Jr. around. He's obviously been at Mar-a-Lago. He's been part of the transition team. He has really managed to get the ear of Donald Trump, and now seemingly managed to get potentially a very powerful job in his upcoming administration.
Jessica Parker, thank you very much. Well, let's talk to a professional in the health field. Dr. Siren Madad is an American pathogen preparedness expert and infectious diseases epidemiologist based in New York. Dr. Madad, thank you for being with us. What do you make of this nomination?
Well, I can tell you, you know, as someone who's, you know, working in the public health community, this is sending shockwaves among our public health community. This is not good news. This is news that is certainly very concerning to all of us, because as someone who is being nominated for one of the highest positions in public health and in our healthcare kind of field, someone who is able to shape the nation's public health policies and oversee a very large range of programs and agencies that impact American health and well-being, this is an individual that's being nominated who, as you've already mentioned, is a known vaccine skeptic. This individual has no expertise, training, or credentials that would even qualify him to speak on health topics, let alone oversee it.
But presumably public health is a shared responsibility under the American system between the federal authorities and the state authorities. I mean, we saw a fair amount of divergence, didn't we, in how states handle COVID. They presumably will still have quite a lot of room for manoeuvre, regardless of what Robert Kennedy is saying at the microphone or dictating from Washington.
That's correct. And so, you know, states and local governments certainly, you know, hold the power in shaping public policy. But that doesn't mean that even if RFK Jr. doesn't change any formal policies, his public statements as the head of HHS, which is a very powerful position, will still carry significant weight. And what this is going to do is it's going to create more mis- and disinformation. It's going to deter millions of individuals, for example, from seeking vaccination or following proven health guidelines. And so that erosion of trust without even changing public policy is still going to be very significant.
He hasn't suggested in any way rowing back on the Affordable Care Act, though, presumably, which was the big kind of landmark piece of legislation to try and increase the number of people with health cover.
Correct. But, you know, his agenda of make America healthy again, if you actually look into it at face value, it sounds great, right? We all want to make America healthy. We all want to live healthier lives. But if you look at some of the claims that are being put in there, it's conflating, you know, good ideas with bad theories and bad public health measures. So you can make, you know, for example, ice cream organic. And he's saying, you know, let's make Medicaid pay for organic meals. But that's not getting to the fact that, you know, we need better nutritional food, access to health care, you know, for Americans.
Dr. Siren Madad in New York, thank you very much for talking to The World Tonight. Our main headline so far: the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, has said that Brexit's weighed on the economy. He called on the government to rebuild relations with the EU while respecting the decision of the British people to leave. Now, let's move on to South Africa, where the recovery of a body from the shaft of an abandoned gold mine earlier today has drawn attention to a group of people living almost entirely underground. Known as Zamazamas, in English, those who take a chance, they search for gold in shafts the mining companies have largely worked out. 2 years ago, one of them spoke to the BBC's Africa Eye programme about how frightening life can be.
Maybe it was my second time underground. I started using the wrong parties and then I was underground for 2 days, directionless. I can't know which way can take me outside. It was Friday, Saturday, Sunday, no food. And then the other guys, when they came Sunday, going to work, they found me.
Well, in the last couple of days, 7 people have been brought alive from the mine at Stilfontein, about 140 kilometres southwest of Johannesburg. Brigadier Athalenda Mate, who speaks for South Africa's National Police, told journalists they'd also been handed over a body from inside the mine.
We do have a decomposed body that was brought up this afternoon. We can confirm that we have registered an inquest to the death. We can confirm that the pathologists have arrived. Our detectives are also on the scene, and necessary crime scene experts take over the crime scene and so on.
The police have also defended the tactics they're using to try to bring potentially hundreds of people, some even say thousands, to the surface, including stopping food and water getting in. But tonight, a local community leader told SABC, the broadcaster, that several are dead underground. Others are said to be eating toothpaste mixed with vinegar to try to stay alive. Well, Kimon de Groof is currently writing a book on the Zamazamas. Speaking to me from Johannesburg, he told me something of their history.
when South Africa's massive gold mining industry largely closed down beginning in the 1980s, large amounts of gold remained in the ground, and there was a large laid-off workforce of people who knew where that gold was and were without work.
One of the things that seems to be causing controversy, certainly among the families of some of the men who were working underground, is a police decision to effectively starve them out. Is that something that's unusual, or is it actually quite routine? I mean, is it, for example, something that the companies have done in the past when they've discovered that people are operating in some of their unused shafts?
It's absolutely happened before. It's also, from the perspective of a company or a law enforcement agency, it's pretty much the only way to get people out of the tunnels, which is not to say that it's morally right or acceptable, but we're talking about kilometers deep shafts, 1 to 2 kilometers, sometimes deeper, thousands of kilometers of horizontal tunnels connecting them at different levels underground. Many of these shafts have been abandoned for decades. They don't have lighting. They don't have air conditioning. Many of them are flooded with water. The temperatures are 45 degrees or hotter. So it's not really like an environment where you can send your squads in to go and arrest these people. And so if you want to get people out from underground, the only way to do it is to cut off the supply of food and water that's sustaining them down there. Because once people go down, they can stay down for months and sometimes years. There's accounts of when these guys come to the surface, they'll be blinded for days. You know, if you think you've been in the dark cinema and you go out and it's bright, imagine what it's like being in the sheer darkness underground with torchlight and coming out.
These mines, so, as you say, some of the shafts are abandoned. Presumably some of them are still active. So the actual way these guys operate, presumably, is pretty surreptitious. It's not just a case of being underground and you can move around freely. You've got to be aware, presumably, that there might be a mining operation going on just one shaft away.
It is surreptitious, but it's also done often with collusion from employees on the functioning mines who have been arrested countless times smuggling food in, smuggling gold out. People get bribed to allow Zamazamas to ride the transport cage to a certain level of the mine and then walk in and then cut across to a disused area. So There's a sort of nuanced ballet that's going on underground.
Now, you talked about the shrinkage of the kind of legal mining industry, which presumably left a lot of miners without work. Is it just former miners who are doing this, or are there other groups that are drawn to this activity?
When police make arrests now of Zamazamas underground, normally a large proportion of them are from Lesotho, from Mozambique, and from Zimbabwe. Undocumented migrants who come here, sometimes under the illusion that they are going to be working on a functioning mine. So there's like labor brokers who recruit people and say, you're going to go work on the mines. And then they arrive and only to find out that they're working on an illegal mine with no health and safety that involves sometimes climbing down a rope into a 2 kilometer shaft by gunpoint. That does happen to people. I would say there's not a ton of sympathy for Zamazamas because South Africa has a fairly heated xenophobic kind of populist thing going on. At the same time, in mining towns where Zamazamas are clamped down on successfully, the local economies and local South Africans have taken very hard hits because there's less money going into the car dealerships, into purchasing food, into all of these other things.
People listening who think this has got nothing to do with me, what would you say?
All of the gold coming out of Zamazama mining activity in South Africa finds its way onto the legal market, gets laundered in. Most of it sells in the Middle East and travels around the world. So there's a chance that anybody wearing gold jewelry, statistically, most of the gold ever mined in the world has come from South Africa. So there's a good chance some of it's from here.
That's Kimon de Groof. On the 14th of December 2012, 20 children aged between 6 and 7 years old were murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, along with 6 adults who worked there. The distress of families was compounded years later when Alex Jones, a US radio host and proponent of conspiracy theories, declared the shooting a giant hoax perpetrated by opponents of gun ownership. A number of families sued for defamation and they won. Alex Jones was ultimately ordered to pay $1.5 billion in damages. Today it was announced that in conjunction with the families, The Onion, a satirical newspaper and website, has bought Jones's site, InfoWar. Robbie Parker's daughter, Emily, was one of the 20 children murdered at Sandy Hook. He's just published the book, A Father's Fight, taking on Alex Jones and reclaiming the truth about Sandy Hook. And he joins us now. Robbie Parker, welcome to The World Tonight. Can you give us a sense of why parents were supporting this purchase?
Good evening. Thanks for having me. The reason that the Connecticut plaintiffs joined together in this lawsuit was because Alex Jones was doing immeasurable harm, not only just to Sandy Hook families, but to a vast number of people and to our country. And our goal in the lawsuit was to hold him accountable and to the lies that he was spreading and make it hard for him to continue to spread those lies. So the fact that his business has been sold because of the bankruptcy proceedings that came out of the verdict we received is a big win for us.
What does it mean for you personally when you think of the impact of some of the stuff he was saying had on, if you like, the memory of Emily and the reasons, the terrible reasons she was taken from you and your family?
Right. The impact it had on us was immediate from what Alex Jones was doing. My daughter was killed because she was sitting in her elementary school classroom. And for Alex Jones immediately to come out and start claiming that this was a hoax, it defiled who Emily was. It defiled her name and her memory. And it compounded our grief. He robbed our family of our ability to start grieving in a healthy way. And so when I say that that's an evil act, that's what I mean by that. And so what he did was atrocious, and it put our family in harm's way. His followers sent death threats and attacked us and Emily's sisters and my wife. And so us needing to fight against somebody like Alex Jones just to be able to get space to grieve was really important.
Did you think more than once about going ahead and writing the book for the reason that it would simply have one effect, which would be to encourage another set of people to have a go at you?
No, that definitely crossed my mind. And for years, I took that approach and I didn't engage at all. And that was very harmful to me and to my family's healing process. And so just joining the lawsuit took a tremendous amount of effort for me to overcome my fears and insecurities. This book actually wasn't ever really meant to be seen by anybody. I just started writing because I wanted to understand my own grief. And as I started to share that with people, I realized that I actually started connecting with other people and they connected back with me. And that brought a lot of healing. And so going through the lawsuit and the trial showed me that I can stand up to bullies like Alex Jones and people that follow him. And I'm going to reclaim that power back that I gave up for so long.
One last thought. The Onion, it's a satirical magazine. It responds to mass shootings by publishing the same headline, quote, "No way to prevent this, says only nation where this regularly happens," unquote. Do you hope it can use InfoWar in a positive way?
I think it will. I mean, it's on the Alex Jones deals in conspiracies and has no truth to it. And the Onion deals in satire, which has shreds of truth in it. And so I think there is a lot of good that can come out of this. And I just like, I'm a fan of The Onion because it does.
Robbie, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. We're losing your line. But thank you so much for talking to us. Robbie Parker there, whose book is A Father's Fight, Taking on Alex Jones and Reclaiming the Truth About Sandy Hook. Now, yesterday, without much fanfare, the government said it was shutting the Office for Place, part of the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. It was set up by the last government to help create beautiful, successful and enduring places that foster a sense of community, local pride and belonging. Well, just this week, a think tank suggested our surroundings materially affect our mood, which gave me an excuse to get out of the studio. Now, I've just come out of Barbican Station in the City of London and I'm about to approach a place that rather makes me feel gloomy. It's part of the Barbican Estate. There's a kind of plenitude of concrete towers rising above me. The reason I'm here is because of a new report that's just been released by the Centre for Social Justice, which suggests a link between buildings, the environment around us, and our sense of well-being, of loneliness. Now, some of the press coverage has talked about ugly estates making us depressed, and that's annoyed some of the architects who think there's a distinction between ugliness
and livability. They think it's more important that a place is livable than it's pretty. And I'm going to meet one of the architects who feels that opinion very strongly.
I'm Melis Howard. I'm a director at Archaeo Architects. We're specialists in social housing, community-led housing, and working with communities to deliver housing.
Right, describe what we've got around us.
So we're in a 1950s estate in central London. It's called the Golden Lane Estate. It was designed by the same architects as the Barbican, but it was a precursor to that. So what we're in is an estate of about 500 homes, and it's concrete. You can see things that people don't like.
And their towers.
Their towers, it's high density, it's flatted development with some maisonettes. It's got all the ingredients of what people term ugly. But the reason I have a problem with that is that actually this place is full of community spirit. And as someone who's briefly lived here and who's studied this place, I know that this place and everything about it delivers really good quality of life. So, first of all, what can you not see? You can't see any cars.
No, that's
There's
true.
No cars. The cars are hidden away. And look, we've got school children walking past. We've got people strolling through the estate. Down there, do you see how people have put their tables and chairs outside their flats in this communal garden?
Right, so this wouldn't be supplied by the estate. This is individuals living on the estate.
And I think if people are leaving their plant pots, their furniture, they feel safe.
Yes.
Things aren't going to get nicked. And also, they feel a sense that they can be there and they can occupy that undefined space. I'm not suggesting every new development can have this, but this place has a swimming pool, tennis courts, a community centre, lots of green space. But I think the key to unlocking loneliness is also about creating really good routes. If you're walking down a narrow internal corridor, you're so much less likely to stop and have a quick chat with your neighbour.
Most of our relationship with neighbours start with a nod, a smile, a good morning, or something like that, don't they?
You don't need to pre-program these things, but you need to make sure that you're thinking about how people are moving around a place.
You mentioned something to me, tennis courts. Let's go and have a quick look, because there'll be a lot of developers who listen and say, and a lot of local authorities who are involved in social housing and say, yeah, it's great, but actually, we need more housing. We know the government's talking about 1.5 million new builds, and space is precious in a lot of developments, and they won't necessarily see this lovely swimming pool I can see right now, or the tennis courts you're going to take me to, as being the best use of space when there's a shortage of space for people to actually live in.
Yeah, and as someone who's working, frankly, at the coalface of social housing, I'm very acutely aware of the need to maximise the potential of every site to deliver housing numbers. Only 6% of buildings in the UK are designed by architects. And it's because a lot of house builders use sort of cut-and-paste housing, particularly edge-of-town developments, you know, the kinds of normal things we see where the car is king, etc. And I think they are not thinking about people and about how we should be communities.
Now, this is called the under fives play area. I think one or two of the kids might be a bit over, but the parents are watching from just outside. Again, a concrete curved barrier to protect it and keep the kids in. Let's just break off a moment and see what some of the people who live here think.
It's a lovely place, lots of usable facilities. I love the green spaces. You can just use it every time of year.
I just love it to live here, you know. I like the community, I like the people. People are very friendly, very helpful. The only thing I will miss is probably more benches so we can like sit down and maybe even have a coffee, you know, the coffee from home.
On the Golden Lane Estate with residents and architect Melis Hayward. Just time for our closing Haywards. Melis Howard, I should say. Just time for our closing headlines. Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey has used his Mansion House speech to urge relations be rebuilt with the EU, saying Brexit, though it must be respected, has weighed on the economy. And within the last few minutes, the death has been announced of Shel Talmy, who produced early hits My Generation for The Who and You Really Got Me by The Kinks. He also worked with David Bowie. He died in his sleep at the age of 87. That's the world tonight. I'm Sean Lay, back tomorrow. Have a good night.